Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey everybody, just wanted to let you know that we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus. If you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, you can support us there for just $3 a month. As our Patreon community grows, we'll be able to offer more perks that pertain not just to the podcast, but our website as well. Again, that's patreon.com/filmcolossus.
I'm Chris Lambert.
And I'm Travis Bean.
Welcome to Film Colossus,
your guide to movies.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I did the finger guns again. I gotta stop that.
I feel like we have to be like very uplifting and bubbly at the start of this episode because, you know, the themes of the movie that we're talking about, kind of sad.
Really? Because it's about capitalism. Every movie about capitalism these days is bright and cheery.
Just a fun, roaring good time.
Parasite, Shoplifters, Nightcrawler. I mean, those are all just fun times at the movies.
You know, when you put it that way.
There have been a lot lately.
They all were kind of fun too.
Yeah, they were grand times.
As dark as they are, there's just that little twinge of like
it's cheeky, right? Like they're all a little satiric. Like they kind of poke fun at how ridiculous capitalism is.
Right, like Parasite being a dark comedy and then Nightcrawler being like the underdog story but with a completely horrible person.
Yeah, we've come a long way since Citizen Kane.
Amazing. But Triangle of Sadness, what a movie. I just want to get that out.
I think you're a big fan of this, right?
I am, especially, you know, rewatching it for this episode. I was a big fan when I saw it in theaters. I forget what movie. Oh yeah, my friend and I went and saw Goodnight Mommy.
Oh yeah.
And we're just sitting there like, ugh.
That movie would be called The Boys.
Yeah, The Boys. The Little Boys. Goodnight Mommy. We saw that. And then we were sitting there and we're like, well, in 10 minutes, the next movie that plays in this theater, or that plays across the hall, is Triangle of Sadness. Like, should we just go see it? And it happened to be the weekend that it came out. Like, was really excited and went in and saw it and went from supreme disappointment in Goodnight Mommy to just being so blown away and happy. And when I was rewatching it, I was just reminded of how up my alley this movie is.
It is very much up your alley.
Yeah, there's movies that I watch where I'm like, this is a Travis movie, and I think this is probably you having the reverse experience.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I could tell how inspired you were by it, because like your piece on it on Film Colossus it's fantastic. Like it really does break down what the movie is doing on a structural level. So when you kind of look at the scope of it and what it's saying, like, it's saying a lot. It's trying to go after all these different areas. And if, like, I know anything about Christopher Lambert, like, that's what he wants.
It's absolutely what a Chris Lambert is looking for and hoping for.
For the record, I like when movies say lots of things, too. But it's just, like, I think it's the path the movie can take is where we diverge.
Yeah, that is definitely a divergent point for us.
Yeah.
For us,
as we'll soon find out.
Yeah, but I'm excited to talk about this because it's one that I saw, like, I guess near the end of last year, but it's kind of fallen off my, just the distance from it. I kind of forgotten how, like, revved up I get about this movie, and then rewatching it, I'm just like, yes, 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 let's talk.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. Before you, did you pay for a ticket to go see A Triangle of Sadness, or did you sneak in?
I did what any good anti-capitalist would do. No, I paid. I have.
I think at Alamo, you kind of have to pay, don't you?
Yeah, and I have the Alamo Draft House movie pass, so kind of didn't pay, but I kind of very much did pay.
All right, you don't have to brag.
You know, I just got the movie pass. No big deal.
Okay, but so before you may or may not have snuck into this movie, what did you know about the movie? What were your expectations?
Okay, I have never seen another Ruben Östlund. Östlund?
I have not either.
Film. I remember Force Majeure. I don't know how you say that either. Oh my God. Force Majeure for Force Major being like highly acclaimed when it came out in 2014, but I never saw it. And then The Square was another one that I remember seeing posters for it, people talk about it, but I was kind of caught up in other work and didn't get to it.
Yeah.
So Triangle of Sadness, Draft House just played the shit out of the trailer for like months leading up to the movie. And it got to the point where when the trailer would come on, I would just like put my head down or look away. I was so tired of seeing it. And plus I knew I wanted to see the movie. So like seeing all the scenes over and over and over again, you kind of start to, cause I was going to that theater like once a week for like months, and it's playing every time. I didn't want to learn what the movie was going to be. So I was excited for it. Then also just like a tiny bit annoyed just because of the seeing the trailer so much.
Yeah. Right.
But I think I remember hearing good things about it after it premiered at Cannes or something.
Well, yeah, it won the Palme d'Or, which is that Cannes?
Yeah,
that's Cannes. Yeah, that's right. I was thinking it was, but yeah, obviously that's Cannes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first thing that put it on my radar.
Yeah.
Like anything that wins the Palme d'Or, I'm kind of just like, oh, I will probably like this. I'm that kind of person. So
I feel like I want to look at the history and like see what movies have won recently. Let's see. Titane. I haven't seen Titane. Parasite, Shoplifters. Okay. So three of the last four movies they've rewarded have been about capitalism. That's good to know. Blue is the Warmest Color, I remember enjoying. Tree of Life. Okay. So they Peach Upon movie. Okay. They reward some good stuff.
Yeah, and The Square had previously won. Is he one of the only two-time winners?
I would think it doesn't happen very often.
Dardenne?
Oh, they win twice?
Yeah, La Fonte and Rosetta.
Wow, I mean, Rosetta, shit, that's an amazing movie. All right, Palme d'Or, you get my vote of confidence.
What a great history of award winners. Like,
wow. Wild at Heart was the only one David Lynch won for. That's crazy.
Paris, Texas won.
Wow. Yeah, The Piano, Barton Fink. Yeah, I mean, this is like a who's who of like Criterion movies.
Yeah, Taste of Cherry.
Yeah, it's Kiarostami.
Yeah, I knew that you would like that.
Fuck yeah.
Kurosawa even won. Like, hell yeah.
Although Taste of Cherry is one of my least favorite Kiarostami movies. Anyway.
Still. Kiarostami getting recognized.
Absolutely. I like that.
Palme d'Or. Look at you go.
Yeah. Okay. So that is definitely, that's a good thing. They win that. Like, I'm in. I want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, were you seeing trailers? Like, what was your first, what did this jump out to you?
So didn't see the trailer in theaters because I wasn't going to the theater.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the pandemic and having a kid and everything. But, definitely saw the trailer. I think I saw it one time on YouTube because my wife and I will watch trailers on YouTube. And notoriously, my wife just instantly forgets trailers, like doesn't remember. And I'm like, oh, we should watch Triangle of Sadness. She's like, what's that movie? And I'm like, are you serious? Like, don't you remember the trailer where like people are puking? And like, basically the thing I knew about this movie more than anything, the thing that stuck out to me was the puking. Like, yeah. I knew there was a scene where like everyone gets seasick. And I was just like, and I was kind of dreading the movie for that. Like, I am somebody who gets seasick. I get motion sickness. And not that, like, it's not like watching this movie is going to make me sick, but like, I don't particularly want to watch that. That is a thing. Like, I can handle a lot of types of humor, but like, I kind of have a hard time like laughing at like defecation and like puking and like, I don't know. It's just always something I cringe a little bit when it happens in movies, but
yeah.
But that's basically all I knew about it. I was interested in it. My confidence that it would be good lessened when it got nominated for Best Picture, because that's usually not a great sign. But the fact that it won the Palme d'Or, like, I'm interested. I'm definitely going to watch it. I just didn't know. And once I found out it was coming out on Hulu, I was kind of jacked. I was like, all right, finally, like I can just watch it. Not for free, I pay for it, but it's the easiest way to watch it now.
Yeah, it kind of surprised me how long it took for Triangle of Sadness to make it to streaming services.
I mean, there aren't a lot of Best Picture nominees on streaming services, but you're right, it's been out for a while, so you would think it would have gotten there sooner.
Yeah, the U.S. release date was October 7th.
Oh, so, like, wow.
It's been out for kind of a minute.
Yeah. But the thing I will say though is like I didn't really know what the movie was about. Like, even though I'd seen the trailer, like, it doesn't necessarily tell you what the movie is. Like, I don't know, the commentary is, it's much richer than I expected and much more sprawling than I expected, whereas I thought the movie would be a little more focused. Like, it's much more sprawling.
Yeah, that was the thing that really jumped out to me, because so much of the trailer's the yacht, like the boat, the cruise.
Yeah.
You kind of, I think my expectation was, okay, we start with like people boarding the ship and go out on the ship and see what like drama happens. The fact that we start, though, the Carl like H&M Balenciaga scene, I did really love that in the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that that was going to be part of it, but just the opening scene of the movie is so incredible to me.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
I would say the first part one is, in my opinion, like the most enjoyable part.
Yeah, on rewatch, I think part three on my first watch was the one, The Island, that amazed me the most because I was so happy that the movie went there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, I didn't think it would have this whole third chapter where they're shipwrecked on the island. From the trailer, you saw like a moment where they're on the island. So I was like, oh, probably the last like 10 minutes that are just like on this island. But the fact that it's like a whole...
It's a third of the movie.
Yeah, a third of the movies on this island was amazing to me. But on rewatch, the amount of work that Carl and Yaya scene does, and knowing thematically that this movie is about economic systems, or just systems in general, and the way in which being in a different system changes who you are as a person, the playfulness of that opening scene took on a far more like deeper subtextual meaning, especially in that moment where the interviewer, the documentary guy, is saying like, oh, it's a moody brand like Balenciaga, and they go all serious, and then H&M, and you smile. That right there encapsulates everything that the movie is doing, saying that who we are, how we present ourselves, changes based on the context of whatever system that we're in, whatever role that we have in that system. So when you're in the system of Balenciaga, you're this person. When you're in the system of H&M, you're this person. When you're in this capitalistic system that determines like your worth based on like how much money you have, you get treated like this. You act like this. When you're stuck on an island where the thing that makes you valuable is your survival skills, you get treated like this versus the way that the models get treated. Like, the system dictates who we are, and who we are does not dictate the system. And there's so much grandeur and scope and scale and depth of thought and amazingness that comes from having that as a premise and the way in which this movie explores it. I'm just blown away that every scene feels so casual, but is also incredibly pointed and purposeful in what it's commenting on and demonstrating.
Yeah. And the kind of key to all that is Carl. Like, he's somebody who, like, he's involved in each part, and he's somebody who's, he's like, between him and Yaya, who, to me, Yaya's almost just more of like an element of what Carl's going through and like what he perceives he needs in life and like what he's going after. Like, I feel like the focus is really more on him as we move from situation to situation. You know, he starts with Yaya, where he's upset that she doesn't want to pay the bill, and he's sick of this system, this gender based system where like he has to pay and like she gets to sit back, and he's frustrated by that makeup. Then he moves on to the yacht, where he's surrounded, but suddenly he's an equal to everybody. Yeah. Like, he is treated with the same, like, if he gets upset about one of the workers on the yacht, that guy's going to get fired. Like, all of a sudden he has this immense power, and it's not like it just goes to his head or something. Like, he's looking around and like doesn't really understand it. He's trying to make sense of it. He's trying to figure out like why the system is this way and how he fits into it. And then you move to the island where everybody's the same again, except they're all under Abigail's command. And he realizes like how you can get ahead in this new system. Like, he can suddenly be above everybody if he gets in with Abigail. And so each situation, you kind of see him maneuvering around and like seeing how the makeup of each system and how it evolves and why it can change and all that. And so, yeah, he becomes like the driving force of that commentary.
Yeah, it's very well explained. And I was laughing on the rewatch because I don't know if this is me overreading, but when he and Yaya are fighting and they get to the elevator, which the elevator moment is so so good, like when the door closes and then it opens. She at one point takes the $50 bill and starts to stuff it down his shirts. And it's a moment that kind of reads a little bit like he's being paid off for his services in a way, like that you would pay a prostitute, like kind of thing. Like she's putting money down his shirt and he recoils, like, why would you do that to me? Don't do that to me. Like, don't put like stuff like down my clothes. Almost like he's a stripper, like being used for his body. And then at the end on the island, he is used for his body. Like Abigail is just using him and he's complicit. His looks. And he's complicit. And it plays on the fact that at the beginning, he said he didn't want the traditional gender roles. And now he's essentially like the mistress to Abigail. Like the traditional like feminine role in the dynamic, which... amazing.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, we're talking about all these movies lately that have really made capitalism the central theme. And we're seeing, you know, just from the Palme d'Or, like the last three out of the last four movies that were awarded have had that theme. Like, it's such a moment for that it's been interesting to see like how all these different movies navigate it and explore the subtleties of it and the like, essentially the cruelties of capitalism. This movie, I feel like, takes like, yeah, Parasite's a black comedy, but Triangle of Sadness feels more of like an actual satire to me. Like, it reminded me a lot of, have you ever seen The Exterminated Angel?
No, I've always meant to.
It's, that movie is incredible. I'll share it with you. And I don't remember the woman's name, but I read an article once about The Exterminating Angel and how it's basically based on Nietzsche's theory of psychoanalysis and how the idea that if you can, like, if you revisit your past, if you recall these memories, that you can, well, I guess I should explain the plot of the movie for anyone who doesn't know it. Basically, the plot's very simple. It's a bunch of rich people who show up to a dinner party. They get stuck, and they, at the end of the night, when it's time for them to all leave, they don't leave. They just like all stay in the room, and to the point where they start to just lay down and fall asleep. And the next morning, when it's definitely time for them to go, they don't go. And they kind of start freaking out. Like, nothing's stopping them from leaving. The door's right there, but they don't leave. And they can't figure out like why they're not leaving, yet they really want to leave. It's surreal. It's satire. It's just mocking. It's mocking the bourgeoisie, of course, but it's also kind of getting at the psychological barriers we put in front of ourselves. And I read this article that was all about like detailing Nietzsche's theory about psychoanalytics and like how people overcome these sort of dilemmas. Like when you're just stuck in a problem that's very simple to solve, but like you can't find the exit, like, there's a whole science and discussion around like how you actually do that. And the movie's essentially about that, while at the same time being about capitalism. It's kind of a very nuanced, it's almost like capitalism and class is tangential to like a much larger point. And I feel like that was always the case with movies that really focused on capitalism. Like we talked, like I mentioned, Citizen Kane. Like, of course, that movie's the result of a capitalist structure, but it's not necessarily about capitalism. Yeah. Lately, movies are about capitalism. Like, Parasite is very much about capitalism. Even though I think there's a little more nuance in that movie than Triangle of Sadness. Triangle of Sadness is so bluntly and openly about capitalism. Like, the entire structure, Carl's entire journey, everyone he encounters is like just a very idiotic version of like a rich person. Like, Dimitri is the king of shit. Like, he's proud of it. It's and like, you know, Woody Harrelson thinks everyone's an idiot and he just like accepts that he has to like, you know, suck up to them. All of it is just it's very blatant in a way that, while as somebody who despises capitalism, like, I like it. Like, that's great. Like, tear down all the stupid people. On another level, like, I think it's the thing I struggle most with this movie, because everything you're describing is so awesome. I really like the structure. I really like going after capitalism. But I kind of wonder how much bite the movie really has when, like, I wonder how deep the commentary is when the characters themselves within, like, a very impressive structure are just, like, stupid people, you know? Like, everyone, like, how much nuance does Carl really have? I guess Carl, he has the most nuance, so that isn't fair. I actually kind of like his character, but, like, Dimitri, like, what does he really represent to Carl if, like, he's just an idiotic rich guy, you know? It's the kind of the thing I keep coming back to in this movie where, like, I look at things like Nightcrawler and I'm like, that is such a deep character study that then allows the capitalism talk to have so much more vigor and power. Citizen Kane, obviously, like, because that character is so strong, because all of the characters in Exterminator and Angel are so well colored and designed, like, that to me helps the message strike, where in this movie I'm kind of like, I'm just really looking at the structure of it and impressed on all the different things it's trying to say, but I kind of wonder how well it's saying all those different things.
I get that. Part of me, as you're describing, like, when you started and you're talking about the satire element, like, there's clearly that satire element, but then part of me is also wondering, like, there's such subtlety to a lot of the characters, especially in the beginning before we get to the yachts, and even somewhat in the aftermath, or, like, some of the crew on the yachts. Not everybody is such a caricature, and it makes me wonder, like, instead of viewing someone like Dimitri as, like, a satirical, over-the-top character, are we supposed to read it more as literal? Like, there are very much these, like, Dimitris. Right. Like, there are these Veras that make this request. Like, I'm thinking back to, I mean, I've been around, like, a ton of, like, that kind of wealth, but just thinking, like, you know, when we go to Sundance, some of the people that we see, or,
yeah, right,
like, when we went to that one party at Sundance, some of the people that we saw.
For sure. Yeah. They're there. They exist.
They're there. They exist. And it's like, like, yeah, or, like, Winston and Clementine are a little, like, I think Winston and Clementine are probably the most, like,
they were the ones I was thinking of as you were saying all this, because, like, they're so over the top.
They're so over the top. Like, I can believe Dimitri. I can even believe, Woody Harrelson as the captain. But Clementine and Winston are the two, with them just, like, picking up the grenade and being like, this is one of ours.
Yeah, right.
And then it blowing up. That is where it starts to, like, tip a little to me, to where I'm like, yeah, yeah. But I think with the way that, like, Abigail's character is handled, with the way some of the other characters are handled, that there is that degree of, like, enough realism that there's an acceptance of, like, yeah, the Dimitris do exist. Like, as over the top as he feels, or as disconnected as Vera feels, as, like, excessive as they might seem.
Yeah.
These are real people.
I don't necessarily deny that. Like, Dimitri almost could just be somebody's uncle that I've met before. Like, he's just, like, an eccentric guy. But I'm thinking more of, like, what the movie actually focuses on, and, like, what we actually hear them talk about and the way they're presented. Like, I just can't help but feel this movie starts to feel a little misanthropic. Like, all Ocelyn is saying is, like, people are stupid and annoying and terrible. And Carl's just kind of caught up in it. Like, he's ends up being kind of a sympathetic character, as I think you pointed that out in your article. Like, he's kind of stuck amidst all these, like, terrible people. And again, all about satire, all about making fun of people, of rich people, of people who believe in capitalistic structures. And, like, I'm all for going after that mentality. I think it just might be more of a personal thing to me that I'm like, are these characters actually handled in the most interesting way? Because, again, I compare it to something like The Exterminating Angel, where all those characters are so ridiculous and so over the top in a way that doesn't bother me, because, like, it comes to define who they are so well, and their dynamics off each other, like the what they create all together adds up to something like lively and in the moment and telling. Towards this, like, maybe it's just like the nature of the movie and what Austin's going for in the structure. Like, it's much more sprawling, like people are sprinkled throughout, and they're all very much their own people, and who they are as their own people are just like, they're just sometimes kind of dumb to me. Like I'm less, I wish I could be more impressed by it, but I wonder, like, how deep is the commentary really when Dimitri is just like the king of shit? Like, that kind of is all I need to know about him, you know?
Yeah, I guess my counter to that would be, like, I don't know if it's about the people so much as the structures.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not saying, like, look how dumb, like, Dimitri is and he's wealthy, but more so, like, what's it mean in this system that somebody like Dimitri can become a king of something?
That's true, yeah.
And what's that say about the system? And that it's, the characters are less of the emphasis than the situations that they find themselves in. I'm not saying that makes it better, that you have, like, anybody would have to suddenly be like, oh, I have to like it now.
Yeah,
but right. Just if the issue is the characters, maybe there's more richness, or like a superficiality of the characters. Maybe there's more like depth and richness to find if the frame is it that the focus is on the people so much as Aslan saying, like, these systems allow this kind of behavior from this kind of person, but in this other system, you get this kind of behavior from this person. Right. And is that conversation interesting enough?
Yeah. Yeah. I've totally thought about that. And I completely agree with you. Like, if that is the driving point of the conversation, like, we're just looking at what these characters represent, I do think that's an interesting conversation, and I'm happy to talk about it, like, on this podcast. Like, this is nice, like, gaining some insight into the movie.
But while watching
it, like, I think that's what it comes back to for me, is, like, not to keep comparing it to Exterminating Angel, because I feel like nobody who's listening to this has ever seen it. You should see it. But, like, the act of watching that, like, being caught up in that movie, like, that to me becomes, like, the driving force of me understanding what it's talking about and being invested in the commentary, where, like, if all the characters of this movie, if they're merely meant to be situational and representative of something and just part of a commentary and not actual people that I get to know and understand, like, to me, that's where a movie can move me, can really, can heighten something, can stir something up with me and unearth these feelings I didn't know I had. To whereas, like, this is just like, you know, I already don't like capitalism. I'm on board with thinking Dimitri's like that. I know Dimitri's of the world probably exist, I guess. Like, people can make their wealth this way. So I guess what I mean when I say, like, satire and, like, speaking to the stupidity of people, like, all that's being pointed out are these things that are meant to alert me to aspects of the world, aspects of capitalism. But as somebody, I guess, I mean, I read a lot about capitalism because I hate it. And I guess I just wonder, like, how much I'm actually gleaning from this movie is my ultimate point.
I get that. I do want to make a statement for anybody that's, like, pedantic like me and say, I think we're using capitalism as kind of a shorthand for, like, economic structures.
Yeah, yeah,
like, class. The island situation is not, like, capitalism.
True, yeah.
And so much like Carl and Yaya at the beginning, it's not as focused on capitalism. It's more like the relationship within a system. But once we get to the yacht, it's much more like, I mean, that's what the captain is debating specifically with Dimitri, is like capitalism versus, it's not necessarily communism, right? But it's like,
just Marxism.
Marxism, other forms of, like, establishment. So the movie, while capitalism does come under siege from Triangle of Sadness, it's really like a criticism of, or even like making the point that all structures have inherent strengths and weaknesses where some people benefit and some people don't. Mm-hmm. And that fluidity is fascinating to me because on the one hand, it almost like tears down the idea of the grass is always greener. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, depending, there's no perfect system. There's no, it's almost like the movie to me is making a case. There's no utopia, that everything has these like pros and cons to it, whereas someone rises and someone falls. Mm. And that's just based on the inherent like idea of like resources and leadership and who we look up to and how that all plays out.
Yeah.
I guess I'm someone that can be enough for me.
For sure, yeah.
Like, I don't, as much as like character journeys can really like impact me, especially in something like fucking Atonement. There's a movie like this where like I don't need Jarmo and Dimitri and the captain to really have like meaningful arcs or characterization,
right.
Or there's just something to the fact of like the emotional catharsis I get is kind of in the recognition of these systems that I'm a part of, and extrapolating like this commentary of who we are in these different situations to my own life and who I've been in different situations that I've been in.
Yeah, right.
That makes like this kind of movie like a very rich experience for me.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't necessarily not feel that way either. It's not like I need a long, winding character arc for Dimitri. Like, he kind of is who he is. Again, I think it's just more of the presentation, like what we know about him and like how he's presented. I mean, the most we get from him, and in my mind, and more of what I'm looking for, is the whole debate he has with Woody Harrelson. That's pretty fascinating. It's inherently fascinating. Maybe that scene went on a little bit too long. But I and maybe that's actually speaking to my point as well, is that like the contrast they share, the debate they have, like that's really interesting to me. Like that's where I can get to know them, and like that's what can give the commentary some richness. But it just drags on for so long, and I don't think what they're talking about like evolves enough to something new that like I think more is being said. Again, it's just like, to me, it's more of a stylistic issue of this movie, like the way it goes about these points. It's a 2.5 hour movie. Like it really spends a lot of time with this stuff. And for a movie spending this much time with all those elements, like, I guess I just expect it to have a little bit more depth. And it's got, not that the depth is there just because like it's covering so much. I guess maybe that's my point, is like it's touching so many different elements that I kind of wonder, like, how deep is it actually hitting all these different elements, as opposed to something like Citizen Kane. Again, like I keep thinking of all these movies, like they don't have to directly be about capitalism or about economic structures to make a larger commentary about economic structures. Like they focus on these like little bits, like Nightcrawler. It's this fascination with becoming the head videographer in the city, of like of getting in with the news network there. Like if you just focus on that, like so much commentary is then extracted from that to economic structures and capitalism and like how it drives people. And so for me, I guess this movie, it all just comes down to like a stylistic issue.
I see that. I'm debating back and forth on how I feel about that, because I almost think if you come back to just the who we are in each system point, then it does kind of stick to just like the one topic and drills down on that. But there's so much that it brings into that conversation. I'm trying to sort out how I feel about that. It'd be like if Nightcrawler had introduced us to like four other potential Nightcrawlers that were like all vying for the same spots, or went from that's interesting.
I think, you know, it's a matter of perspective. Like the way you just described it, I'm now wondering, like, could I have watched the movie that way? Like if I watched it again, would I see it with a new light? Would I see more specificity in the commentary, and like everything happening around that specificity is just like kind of driving home more of a single point. And if that is the case, again, Carl is like,
yeah,
he's the epicenter of all of that. Like he kind of represents what the system means to just a regular person like you or me that's kind of like caught within it and wonders what their place is within it.
Yeah. We both talked about how we love the Carl and Yaya section at the beginning. I think the thing that stands out to me the absolute most, and you kind of got at this earlier, is specifically the scene where he's at the Yaya's fashion show. Well, it's not her, but she's in the show.
She's in it, yeah.
When they make him lose his seat because he's more...
Hilarious, by the way.
Right, these more important people arrive, which causes the other people to get up, and then they ask everybody to move down. And then he's just like without a seat, and they're like, you go sit up here. So he went from having this really nice spot to getting pushed out to like a lower tier. And the contrast between that and when he goes and complains about the guy in the ship who's shirtless,
yeah,
just because Yaya thought he was attractive, and gets that guy fired, and just that switch in power dynamic makes me so happy. So happy.
Yeah. Man, I mean, speaking about, there are plenty of other things I like in this movie for sure, but thinking about like how dragged out that conversation is between Dimitri and the captain, and like how long the puking and shitting goes on, and the island scene in general, which I can't say, it was probably like the part of the movie that lost me the most. Like the beginning to me is, that to me is gripping, you know. I mean, we only have two characters, like it's a little easier for me to get invested in them because like they're the only people I see, but I was very much entranced by their relationship and like everything it was seemingly setting up. It's maybe that's more of what my movie experience was, is like I was so intrigued by what it was, and then like as it stretched out, like it felt like it was saturating a little bit to me.
I could see that. Like the dynamic between them, while it continues to be something you can point to, especially like the dissolution at the end and him going off with Abigail, there's still something about like how that relationship dynamic gets diffused a bit, being part of everything else, that if that was the thing that was like really hooking up front, it feels like it ends with a little bit of a whimper in some ways.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about it, though, I mean, I came into this episode like kind of on the fence about the movie. And the only reason I think the root of me taking any digs at it is just that, like, oh, I can't help but compare it to like every other movie that kind of has similar themes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they're all just doing more, especially The Exterminating Angel. Go watch it. what, by the way, just a side note, The Exterminating Angel was originally, it had some other title, like something to do with like a shipwreck. Like it was like basically kind of the same thing as Triangle of Sadness, that these people are stuck on this island, in quotes, and don't know how to get out. They actually have very similar, not similar structures, I guess, because they're kind of completely different movies, but what they're going for is very similar.
Core concept.
Yeah. But, you know, as we're sitting here and I'm thinking about it, you know, even the island scene where I'm like, yeah, that's kind of my least favorite part. There is a lot that happens on that island scene. Like Jarmo killing the donkey. Like you do get like a little moment with him and like how difficult it is for him to like do this thing he's never had to do before. Like he's just a rich guy and everyone does everything for him. Like suddenly he's forced to kill a donkey or whatever that thing was.
It was a donkey.
Yeah. I guess it that Carl and Yaya, like that does, it extends out so much like that when I take a broad look at it, it seems like too much, but there are a lot of little moments on the ship and on that island that seem to be, that offer some sort of catharsis, that feel climactic to where, like, what direction Carl was heading as he, like, kind of went out into the world and got a better sense of, like, the economic system and his place in it and, like, what you have to do when you're pushed in certain directions. Like, gosh, maybe this movie's just too complicated for me.
I mean, as you're describing that, there is, like, a much more literal movie where Carl and Yaya are just models, and she's more successful at the beginning, and he eventually gets brought into another role that's like less about how talented he is and more about his looks, and ends up like leaving Yaya because of the benefits he gets, and his career starts like taking off in a way that hers isn't, as she's like kind of forgotten in a way.
Yeah, right.
That's far more just like not what this movie, like the same beats but very different exploration of them. But like Jarmo having that moment with the donkey, like Dimitri and Nelson, like their dynamic on the islands, like very interesting.
Yeah.
And just like the communication issues that come up with Therese and the guy trying to sell her things.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And like he's completely oblivious to like her being in a shipwreck state, just looking like there's no humanity from him towards her. It's just like she's a potential sale, and when she's not interested, he completely goes away. There are a ton of like little things. The Exterminating Angel, it was based on a play called The Castaways of the Calais de la Providencia.
Castaway. I was like, I knew it's a C word that has to do with being shipwrecked. I don't know why I couldn't think of it.
Yeah. So Castaways of Calais de Providencia.
I feel like you should speak to the very end of the movie, because what you wrote about it was great. And when I watched it, it's funny because what you describe like is kind of inherent, like you get it, I guess, as you watch it. And I felt some sort of power when I was watching it, but I couldn't quite identify it. But after reading what you wrote, it kind of became like my favorite part.
Yeah, it was one of the things that the ends, I mean, I feel like people know the end if they've watched it, but Carl is left behind as Yaya and Abigail go on a hike. And there's tension because he's become like Abigail's mistress and he's still in a relationship with Yaya. So he's like a little worried about like what's going to happen. Are they going to talk, or they going to like be mad at him, or is something going to happen between them? There's just like a lot of tension between the three of them at that point.
Yeah.
And so Carl's like left behind as they go on the hike. And then eventually Yaya and Abigail discover that they're on this island where there's a resort, and it's just an elevator ride to escape. And that's it. They can be rescued. Things will be good. They'll return to the old world, their previous lives. And Abigail takes a step of killing Yaya because Abigail doesn't want to go back. Yaya does, because back in the other place, Yaya was this model. She had acclaim, esteem. Abigail was a cleaner on the ship.
Yeah.
She had no esteem. Like, she was not the leader of this island colony. So it's very dramatic between them. But then we pick up suddenly with Carl sprinting through the woods and just like tearing off in the jungle. And you're seeing that he's like whipped by these tree branches, and it's like cutting him. And it's not like a casual, I'm going to go for a jog. It's a desperate headlong, fleeing through this jungle. And the movie ends, and we're kind of left like, what's Carl doing?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people that want like the literal, like, what's Carl doing? And with that answer, some think that maybe he heard Yaya scream and went like running to save her. Hmm. Or maybe like Abigail told him what happened and he's like taking off, like something caused it. But I think it doesn't necessarily matter in that way what like the precipitating factor is. To me, it's just like he's trying to escape. He's been caught in these various systems from the start of the movie that he was uncomfortable in. First, it's like the casting call, and then it's the model show, and then it's the fashion show, and then it's like dinner with Yaya. And then on the yacht, we see that he has power, but he's still uncomfortable in that situation. Even with power, he's uncomfortable a little bit with like how to wield it, the consequences of wielding it. And then on the island, he is completely dehumanized and valued only for his physical qualities. It's in some ways going right back to being a model, but a lot more degrading in some ways, that he's just like selling out his body for like access. And so there's something to the idea that he finally couldn't handle being in these situations and is fleeing these systems, which then starts to represent the fact that there's part of all of us that kind of maybe wants to flee a little bit from these systems and structures that we find ourselves like put into again and again, just based on the sheer fact of being alive and being somewhere, and how frustrating and stressful and dehumanizing that can be. So Carl's like fleeing from this thing kind of in some ways represents this escape that we all kind of want or feel like we want from these stresses that we have based on the situations and the economic structures, the political structures, all of that we find ourselves in, both on like the large, like global, national, state, city, local scale, but even in like the interrelationships in our lives and the way in which that dictates who we are, who we can be, what we can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all very well put. Again, like at the end of the movie, like I knew I was experiencing something powerful, and like I knew there was such energy to it that like I was really captivated by it. And I think everything you said is kind of inherent. Like, we probably all just relate to what's happening to him in that moment. But to be able to put it in the words like that, like, really does crystallize what the movie's going for. And again, like, there's such energy to that moment that it does speak a little bit to like what I wish the movie had more. Like, I guess you could make the argument that the whole movie kind of has that energy and is like all a part of that. Like, Carl is always like kind of running. But to make another comparison to The Exterminating Angel, like, to me, the whole movie kind of has that energy and actually ends very similarly. I don't think I'm giving away too much. Like, in the movie, they eventually get out of the room. That shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But how they get out of the room, like, I feel like the whole philosophy of that movie is actually very similar to Triangle of Sadness, in that nothing is stopping these people from leaving the room. Like, there is no force. There's nothing magical happening. Like, they just don't go. They don't realize that the answer to their problem is sitting right in front of them, and they just have to, like, walk out. And the manicness of them, like, as they, like, are, like, trying to figure out how to leave, and then they are able to finally leave, and they, like, run out of the house, to me reminds me of what Carl's going through. How you can just, like, you're so caught up in something for so long, and it's so manic and so crazy and makes no sense, that at the end, like, you just have to run. You just go away. You just run in any direction that takes you away from it. It's the kind of ending that gets me jazzed, because, like, I like endings like this that don't necessarily provide plot resolution, but provide such profound resolution to the themes and the mentality and these kind of universal issues anybody is struggling with. Like, it just represents something inherent to us, which I love. And again, I just wish there was more of that throughout the movie. But the fact that it's able to exist at the end of the movie and have so much meaning, I think does speak to the movie's success, that, like, it does communicate what it's going for enough and has enough nuance throughout that this kind of ending can have that kind of impact.
Yeah, right? Which I think that's definitely something to judge a movie on. Something, I need to rewatch it. I haven't watched it since theaters. The Ghost Rider.
Polanski. Yeah,
I hated the first. Isn't that like a 2-hour 40 minute movie or something?
Oh gosh, I don't know if it's that long.
Felt that long. It was 128 minutes. Yeah,
okay.
So just over 2 hours, but for like an hour and 40 minutes I was sitting there like wanting to just bash my head against the seat in front of me because I was so like bored and frustrated by the movie. But the last 10 minutes were so profound to me, and the final like shot was so profound to me that it completely flipped my experience with the movie to where I was like, did I actually love that? Like, was that actually really good? And I just wasn't putting the pieces together until the end.
I feel like that's happened to me before.
Yeah. I was looking up if anybody else had made the connection between Exterminating Angel and Triangle of Sadness. And the first thing that came up was Armin White talking about it and being like, Ocelyn bungles the political, spiritual, and moral lessons of such classics about chaos as Exterminating Angel, La Ventura, and Godard's The Weeknd, or just Weeknd, not
those. Those are actually good comparisons. In the sense that, like, again, I think that speaks to what I was maybe disappointed about this movie, is it felt a little one note to me, that it was just about economic structures. And not that it is just about that, but it's like, it's such an overwhelming force in this movie that, like, it's what your mind goes to. Whereas, like, Exterminating Angel, La Ventura, and Weeknd, like, it's so much bigger than that, and it is about being wrapped up in chaos, that, like, any movie about somebody being wrapped up in chaos can ultimately be a commentary on somebody being wrapped up in economic systems. Like, there's something universal about it. Anyway, it doesn't surprise me that Armin White doesn't like this movie, because everything he hates is purely political. Like, this is such a liberal movie that I'm sure that drove him nuts.
Yeah, he called it Parasite Part 2.
These days, like, there have just been so many, we didn't even begin to touch the surface of capitalism movies or economic movies going on these days. Like, there's so many.
Yeah, I think I would push back against, like, it being about chaos, because I feel like economic system, like, the systems that are in place aren't chaotic at all. It's like, the structures are very clear and the dynamics are very clear. It's just like chaos kind of enters into the picture at one point in this movie and upends a system. But I feel like even that isn't necessarily chaos so much as like weakness of the system.
Yeah. Maybe chaos is too strong of a word.
But
because it's not necessarily like La Ventura, there's chaos. Like somebody just goes missing and then like there's like existential dread going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, I love Antonioni. Okay, wait. Exterminating Angel or Discreet Charm of the Bourgeois?
Both. Basically, Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie is an extension of Exterminating Angel, except it's much more, that's much more of a satire. Like, all of those characters are just so stupid and ridiculous and, like, keep getting caught up in, like, dreams and, like, don't know what reality is. Like, it's such a fever dream of a movie.
So you prefer Exterminating Angel?
Man, I love both of those movies. I think I would say I prefer the Exterminating Angel.
Okay. I thought I was going to love Discreet Charm, and I didn't.
Mm. That movie, I feel like that's a tough one to find your in with. Like, it's almost actively trying to make you not like it.
Yeah. I love that era of cinema of just, like, weird modernist, like, postmodern, like, bullshit.
Yeah.
What's the Last Year at Marienbad? Like,
oh, yeah.
Discreet Charm. Like, what's the Chris Marker film?
Well, there's Sunless. It's Sans Salil, whatever it's.
Yeah, is that pronounced? Is that the one with the time traveler?
Isn't that that one?
I think so.
I haven't seen a lot of Chris Marker movies. Oh, La Jetée.
Yeah, La Jetée. Okay.
Of course, yeah. Sorry, I was thinking of, like, I don't know why I wasn't thinking of short movies, so I just didn't even enter my thought process.
I feel like the DVD I got of that was, like, Sans Salil and La Jetée, like, double feature.
Probably, yeah.
So I always get, like, which one's which confused in my mind. But, like, that era of films, like, even Weekend is one that I'm just like, this is so bizarre and amazing.
Didn't you and I watch Weekend together?
Yeah, I think in Iowa at one point. Yeah. I was just like, we have to watch this.
That's a wild movie.
Yeah, it's cool. But it's one that, like, on my, like, fourth or fifth watch, I found myself, like, a little less engaged with.
Fourth or fifth?
Wow. Yeah. It was one of the ones that was, like, in rotation where I was just, like, working on other things that have a movie playing in the background. Sure. And eventually I got to the point where I was looking and I was just like, eh.
I feel like, again, Godard, he's another person where, like, he's almost daring you to not like the movie he's made. Like, those movies are just a little harder to penetrate. It's funny to me that you would watch that movie so many times.
Yeah, I mean, it also, I'm sure, makes sense in a way that that would be the one that I gravitated to. I need to watch some of these other ones. Man, well, so
Armand White
to watch.
Sucked us down a rabbit hole there.
Yeah, he really, really did.
Big fan of him, but I don't know. I would have to read what he wrote about this.
He called him a misanthrope.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he added, and a fraud, which feels a bit intense.
That feels very misanthropic of Armand White to say.
Like, a little unnecessary.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely haven't enjoyed his writing as of late as much. I kind of liked him earlier on when he was almost like a protege of Pauline Kael. Like, I liked his energy, but sometimes these days I just don't really enjoy what he writes.
Yeah, it happens. Can't agree all the time. But okay, any other thoughts on Triangle?
The only other thing I'll say is, as much as I don't like watching puking and shitting in movies, I actually thought that whole scene was interesting. Again, went on too long. I didn't need to see that much puke and shit. But I thought it was really interesting that, like, it was such a great little symbol of, like, this boat crashing, or this boat just being filled with all these rich people's vomit and excrement, just because, like, the captain chose this night the worst night of all to have the dinner. And because the food sat out, because one of the rich people wanted to like drag all the people away and make them go in the water. Like there's just such catharsis to that scene. And like as the punishment for all these people and the way they are that I enjoyed.
Yeah. There's like the concept. Fantastic. But I'm also somebody that's like, I have a very like low ceiling when it comes to my like entertainment value gained from like gross out humor. Like I don't know if I've ever laughed at like a fart joke in my life. So it, as much as I like love and adore this movie, even I was just like, that scene's a little too long. And the Woody Harrelson and Dimitri conversation, I was also just like,
I get it.
Yeah. On the one hand, I do love when things like won't end. Like I have a dream that there's going to be a movie where at some point you get two people that reach like a point where one won't budge and the other won't either. Like they're at that much of a, like a, I'm not giving an inch and neither will you. And the last like 30 minutes is just them staring at each other, waiting for one of them to like break.
That's cinema.
Neon Genesis Evangelion had a moment like that near the very end of the show. There's a moment where a character has to kill another character. And like the other character wants them to do it. It's like, you need to kill me in order for this to happen. Like, I'm sorry that this is like your destiny, but like you have to. And the other person is just like, I don't want to. Like, I refuse to do this. Like, don't make me do this. And there's just this moment. I think it's like 3 minutes where you just see like the other character who's in a giant mech holding the other character in the hand. And they're just looking at each other. No cuts, no dialogue, just like staring. And they're not even like moving. And then finally the fist closes. And I love it so much. So I really love these like extended dramatic things, but
eh. Yeah. Speaking of things that won't end, that actually speaks to why I love the discrete term, the bourgeoisie, because throughout that movie, people keep, you watch this whole like wild scene play out, and then somebody wakes up from sleeping and you realize like everything you've seen is a dream. And it happens so many times in the movie that it's like, it just becomes hilarious to me. And it becomes part of the commentary too. Like, you don't know what you're watching is real, like what's imagined. But the fact that it happens so many times, I'm just like, man, Luis Buñuel is the fucking master.
Yeah, it's going to sound stupid and I shouldn't like admit this out loud, but I didn't realize he did Viridiana until just like a little bit ago.
He had such a strange career because he started out very experimental. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of that movie. First movie he made, like Un Chien Andalou. Like it's a famous short film and it's very provocative. So like he made a lot of provocative movies early on. And then for 20 years when he was in Mexico, when he moved to Mexico, he made like very straightforward movies. Like Viridiana like has maybe some more surrealist elements, but like it's kind of a little more straightforward than something like The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie or The Exterminating Angel, where like, and then at the last part of his career, he just let loose and made these very abstract, like bizarre movies. So like, it's kind of hard to know, like, I'm not surprised that you would be confused, but that you wouldn't know like which movies he made.
Yeah, that would, I guess that would do it. I like Viridiana was one that we watched in college in film class.
Yeah, for sure. It's a film class movie.
Yeah, 1000%. I just don't remember us ever talking about like the filmmaker, right? It was all about the scenes and the discussion, but not like extending into Buñuel and like what he was doing and how he was doing it. It was more just like, do you see the commentary being made by having like the homeless men like in this place, like having this party?
Yeah,
all the kind of analytical stuff.
He's great. Everyone go check him out.
He did Robinson Crusoe too.
He did a lot. He did it just so in that 20-year period where he made Viridiana, like he just made so many more straightforward movies. Like not straightforward in the sense that like they're just plain and ordinary, but like straightforward in the like film class kind of way. Where like these are the kind of movies that like lovers of art appreciated back then and the kind of movie you saw more often.
It's funny how this is like a little like nerdy writer thing. Looking at his titles, the way in which his titles like became a lot more excessive.
Yeah.
Where at the beginning, it's like the Golden Age, Magnificent Casino, like adjective noun combos.
Right.
The Great Madcap. Usually that's like pretty standard for the title of something. It's like the noun, adjective noun, or the article, like the thing. You don't... It's become more popular to have phrases or...
Yeah.
Why am I blanking on... It starts with a P, and it's a thing that connects, like, against the frame, above the floor, prepositional phrases.
Okay.
To have, like, kind of the preposition for a title. But by the end, like, he just starts getting into all of these, like, longer titles. Death in the Garden, That is the Dawn, Rehearsal for a Crime, The Discreet Charm, The Phantom of Liberty, The Obscure Object of Desire, like these very extended, like elongated titles, which I think kind of flow well with some of the dreaminess and absurdity.
Yeah, even The Milky Way is like, that title has such power and has seemingly nothing to do with the movie, because like it's just about like these poor dudes wandering like it's not like it has nothing to do with the actual Milky Way.
Oh, it's part of a trilogy. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was. I feel like back then, like, so many movies were trilogies in quotes that like they all had common themes and they were made around the same time.
Man, I just need to do a deep dive.
Yeah, he's great.
Were we talking about another movie at some point?
I don't know. We've come so far.
Was it some like square of destitution?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just making, like, we got so far away from Triangle of Sadness.
Oh, right.
Feels like. I mean, the response to Triangle of Sadness, I think, has been pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
It seems that people have, like, enjoyed it, respected it, been confused by it, but I've seen more, like...
Wow.
Positive commentary for it than negative commentary.
I guess I do understand the confusion in the sense of like Carl running at the end, of course, like you see that and you're like, wait, what was this movie about? But I maybe that's one thing I kind of appreciated about the movie is, to me, it's kind of straightforward about what it's... I mean, there's depth to be found, of course, in the structure, and you wrote about like the depth, so obviously there's more there, but like I kind of like when movies just tell me what they're about. I don't want to have to, like, this sounds bad for somebody who runs a film site that explains movies, but like, I don't want to think about them too much. Like, I'd like to be cued into like what the movie's doing so I can then dig in and find the nuance of how it's expanding on that message. So I appreciated that about this movie.
That it gave you some inroads rather than just being like, hey, go figure it out.
I mean, kind of, yeah. I like that.
It does help. It is nice.
Yeah.
It is a shame that, like, with the how dynamic Harris Dickinson and Cara B. Dean were. Mm-hmm. It's such a shame of what happened to Dean that she passed away before this movie really got to see the light of the day and get the praise and acclaim that she deserved for her work as Yaya.
Wow, I did not know she died.
Yeah, it was a... What was it? It was bacterial sepsis.
Whoa, shit, that's terrible.
Yeah, she had her spleen had been removed from a car crash, and that left her like at risk for infection, and an infection happened. So it was like... I guess it happened in August. So they had won the Palme d'Or at that point, but it was before the film really got to like release.
Hmm. That's too bad. She's really great in this movie.
I know. She did such an amazing job. Her and Dalia de Leon just kind of like stole the film in a lot of ways, even though like Harris as Carl really was kind of the core heart of the film. Like Carl B and Dolly, just the way those characters developed and the tension they had at the end, the scene they share at the end, it felt like star making performances for all three of them.
Dolly de Leon, she's gotten a lot of recognition, I think.
Yeah, she's definitely like been getting talked about a lot more than I think Carl has.
Probably, yeah.
But she arrives with such force when she finally arrives. Like,
it's a scene stealer.
Yeah, like on rewatch, it was funny realizing she was the one that came into the room when Carl and Yaya are in bed, and she's totally like, "Hey," and they're like, "Get out of here." And then for her to be the one in bed with Carl and Yaya knocking on the door, it's a really nice, like, yeah.
You're making me like this movie.
Good.
I appreciate it to the point where, like, I'd be interested to watch it again. Maybe not anytime soon, but, like, I'd be interested to watch it again to see if it captivated me more.
Yeah. Do so. Do so, do so, do so. But I think this is one that's going to have legs for a little bit.
Like, it's already on Criterion. Like, it kind of has that Parasite energy. Like, it's so relevant and it's trying to do so much that, like, there's a lot to talk about and write about.
Yeah. Well, beautiful. Any last thoughts? Any last words?
No, just go check out filmcolossus.com. We're doing crazy good work over there.
Yeah, you know, it's good, it's crazy, it's crazy good, it's good crazy.
And if you want to listen to the show without ads, you can support us on patreon.com/filmcolossus. $3 a month, and you don't have to listen to whatever ads are being inserted in here. I don't even know what they are.
What a wonderful thing that is. Steal. It's a deal.
Okay, you got anything for me?
No, just we'll have another episode. We're talking about another movie soon.
Yeah, what is it gonna be? Last time we said it was gonna be Prisoners and it wasn't, so like you can't even trust us if we named a movie.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this time it's Prisoners.
Maybe we'll just say for now it's Prisoners, but there's an 80% chance it won't be.
I like the idea that we just keep saying it's Prisoners and never do Prisoners.
I don't mind that because I don't want to watch that movie again.
I do.
I do, for the sake, you know, I take that back. I don't mind watching it again if it means I get to trash it.
Oh no. Okay, well, it will be another debate episode.
Yeah, get some things off my chest about Villeneuve. Or how do you say it?
Villeneuve.
God, I'm terrible. I shouldn't complain about it if I can't even say his name right.
That's right.
All right, fair enough.
Up your name game.
That's a good way to end this. Got a big question to ask. Anything? Do you want to do anything?
You know when you're trying to think of a song but just can't quite remember the name? Well, using weed in your teens can make you forget things you want to remember. Want proof? Check out the facts at mindovermarijuana.com. That's mindovermarijuana.com. Sponsored by the California Department of Public Health.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.